Join us now for the Chapel Hour, coming to you from the campus of Bob Jones University. Today's message was preached during a Sunday morning worship service held on the university campus. Following the reading of the scripture from Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 1 through 13, our speaker will be Dr. Jim Berg, Dean of Students at BJU. The title of his message is The Secret of Pleasure.
Dr. Jim Berg, Dean of Students, will be our preacher this morning. And our text this morning for the message is the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 1. The text is actually the first two chapters, but we won't take the time to read both chapters. But we'll read Ecclesiastes 1, verses 1 through 13. Ecclesiastes 1, 1 through 13. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteth to his place where he arose. The wind goeth toward the south, and turneth about unto the north. It whirleth about continually, and the wind returneth again according to his circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. All things are full of labor. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. The thing that hath been, it is that which shall be. And that which is done is that which shall be done. And there is no new thing under the sun. Is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new? It hath been already of old time, which was before us. There is no remembrance of former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of things that are to come with those that shall come after. I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith. May the Lord bless the reading of his word to our hearts. Turn back in your Bibles to Ecclesiastes chapters 1 and 2. The title of the message this morning is The Secret of Pleasure. The Secret of Pleasure. No book has more profoundly influenced me than the book of Ecclesiastes, and I often come back to it. I want to give you a little bit of background of the book. It was written by a man, Solomon, who at age 18 was given a blank check by God. And Solomon made a withdrawal on the Bank of Heaven for wisdom, and God cashed the check. And without doubt, he became the most gifted man conceivable. Ecclesiastes is written at the end of his life. I believe it's a record of his repentance for pursuing life without God at the center of all that he did. It is not the bitter musings of a cynic. It is the inspired instruction by an elderly man who had it all and tried it all. And in the end, finally saw the emptiness of it all without God at the center. You know, there are two ways that you can find out what is really important in life. One is by deprivation, where you have nothing. And some of you have been there and been in situations where, in your families where somebody's health is at stake or their life is at risk. And you know, at those times, nothing else really matters. And when you're deprived of something, the real important things bubble to the surface. And the other way that you can find out what is really important in life is satiation. Have it all in great quantities, and through that also find out what really matters and what is important. And that's exactly what Solomon did. I believe this book is often misunderstood. It is a literary form that is different from most of the rest of the Old Testament. Even when we read those first 13 verses, you may have looked at that and said, what on earth is this about? I read the words, but they don't say anything to me. Well, the exact form of this book, according to some commentators, is a cultural apologetic. That is, it is a defense of a certain worldview. Solomon had distinguished himself
as a philosopher king, as one of the wise men of those days. And there were many philosopher kings in those days and philosopher queens, one of which is the Queen of Sheba, who came to test Solomon with many hard questions. Remember, this was a debate of worldviews. And she came to visit his court and to test him with hard questions. And these philosopher kings and queens would write cultural apologetics or defenses of their worldview, and they would exchange them with other interested philosopher kings as they debated worldviews. And that is the meaning of the verse in chapter 12, verse 12, which I remember as a student claiming as my life verse: of the making of many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness to the flesh. Well, actually, what that is saying is we can exchange these treatises back and forth until the cows come home. It's right there in the Hebrew if you want to check that out. We can do this until the cows come home, but it all boils down to this. And then he gave us a conclusion. And it is the making of these many books, these cultural apologetics that he's referring to here. The original audience is a Gentile audience. And that is why there is no mention of Abraham, of the covenants, of the Exodus out of Egypt, of Jehovah, the covenant name of God. There's no mention of the tabernacle or the temple, because these Gentile philosopher kings would have no meaning to them. Solomon's Jerusalem at this time was teeming with Gentiles. When he would marry a princess bride from another country, in a political marriage, she would not just hop on the next camel train of traders coming to Jerusalem. She would bring her own camel train with her own staff, her own confectioners and bakers and hairdressers and clothiers and leather makers and camel stable boys and all of these. And all of this staff would come along with her. Many, many Gentiles now in Jerusalem. And in fact, we'll look a little bit later about what it took to put on a meal in the dining common here in Jerusalem in those days. There were thousands of people, mostly Gentiles, who were being fed by Solomon at this time. Many, many Gentiles. By that, in addition to that, Solomon had made Jerusalem into a world trade center. He had ships going all over the world, bringing back all kinds of good gold and apes and peacocks and all kinds of spices and many, many other things. There was much trade. Plus, he had conquered the nations around him and placed these Gentile nations under tribute. So there was a lot of exchange with these nations as well. So a very interesting book here, and a very interesting time in Israel's history. Ecclesiastes connects with this unbelieving world, these other philosophers of other worldviews, through one topic, and that is the topic of despair. And if you will turn over to chapter 12 for just a moment, we'll look at the key to this book. Solomon left the key under the back door mat. Ecclesiastes 12, verse 11. He says, "The words of the wise," or we could better think of it as "the conclusions of the thinking man." The conclusions of the thinking man. And he's going to prod them to think. The conclusions of the thinking man are as goads. I think most of us understand what goads are. Those are those long pointed sticks that a Palestinian farmer would thrust into the flank of a slow moving oxen and dragging his plow. And when he would do that to the oxen would get the point. And he would do something. He would move. And Solomon is saying that the conclusions that I want you to draw from these enigmas of life are going to goad you. I want you to be asking yourself, what's the point? And then I want you to do something about that. So part of the instruction here is coming through goads. And then part of it is going to come through nails. By the way, some of the goads we saw in chapter 1, where he says, okay, let's talk about life a little bit. The sun goes through her cycles and comes back again, and rises in the morning, comes back again. The wind rises in one place, circles around, comes back again, and keeps going through its cycles. And the waters flow into the sea, and they go up, and they come down in the rain, and they go through their cycles. But you go around once, and you're dead, and nobody even remembers that you were here. What's the point? See, that's a goad. And the point is, there is no point unless there's something that transcends all of the pointlessness of this life. He says, you lie dead on the ground, your dog lies dead on the ground next to you, and you both die and return to dust. What's the difference? What's the point? And there is no point unless there's something that transcends all of that pointlessness. So part of the lessons in Ecclesiastes are goads. Other ones are nails. Nails are speaking, and he says here, and his nails fastened by the masters of assemblies, which are given from one shepherd. The masters of assemblies is the person who would, in these traveling Bedouin tribes, would set up the tents. And he would use these nails, these large tent stakes, to anchor that tent, the rope that would anchor those tents to the ground and withstand those desert winds. It was an anchor. And while the goads are disturbing reflections as we think about life, they're the conclusions that we think about and lead to the conclusion that what is the point of this? That's what a goad is. A nail is a stabilizing revelation from God that provokes dependency in us on this fallen planet. And we're going to look at a couple of goads and nails this morning. One other thing about the organization of the book, some commentators, and I believe this is correct, divide this into four discourses with a common refrain. It's like there are four stanzas and a refrain, and the same refrain keeps coming up again and again in the book four times. So there are four discourses, and what I'm giving to you in chapters 1 and 2 is the secret of pleasure, the first discourse. When he opens the book, back to Ecclesiastes 1 again, when he talks about vanity of vanities and all is vanity, he's speaking there of the emptiness of life and of the purposelessness of life. Vanity of vanities. It's like chasing after wind. What is the purpose of chasing after wind? So with that in mind, we come down to verse 13, where he kind of gives us his quest in this book. And I gave my heart to seek and search out my wisdom concerning all things that are done under the heaven. I really wanted to find out a lot of things. But he says, this sore travail or this heavy burden is that which God gives to the Son of Man to be exercised therewith. He says, God has given all of us this desire to know these things, but there doesn't seem to be apparent answers. And I'm going to find some answers. Well, what did he do then on this quest? Well, in verses 1 to 3 of chapter 2, we'll pick up in chapter 2. The first thing he did in verses 1 to 3 is he partied. So I'm going to try to find the secret of pleasure. I said in mine heart, go to now, I will prove thee with mirth, therefore enjoy pleasure. And behold, this also is vanity, it's empty. I said of laughter, it is mad. And of mirth, what doeth it? What is the point? I sought in mine heart to give myself unto wine, yet acquainting mine heart with wisdom. And to lay hold on folly till I might see what was that good for the sons of men, which they should do under the heaven all the days of their life. He said, I tried a lot of partying and it ended up being empty. It really didn't satisfy. In verses 4 to 6, he built. I made me great works. I builded me houses. I planted me vineyards. I made me gardens and orchards, and I planted trees in them of all kinds of fruits. I made me pools of water to water there with the wood that bringeth forth trees. He created enormous lakes to water his woods and his gardens. He said he partied, he built, and here's a great one, verses 7 to 8, he shopped. I got me servants and maidens and had servants born in my house. And also I had great possessions of great and small cattle above all that were in Jerusalem before me. I gathered me also silver and gold and the peculiar treasure of kings and of the provinces. I got me men singers and women singers and the delights of the sons of men. He's talking about concubines there as musical instruments and that of all sorts. So he partied, he built, and he shopped in this quest for pleasure. And he summarized his quest in verses 9 to 10, that it brings only momentary pleasure. So I was great and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. I didn't lose sight of my goal or what I was trying to do. And verse 10, and whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor. There was an immediate pleasure in this, and this was all my portion. And this was my portion of all my labor. So he says there was in this labor, in this pursuit of pleasure, no doubt there was joy. But then he begins some of the goads. And remember, goads are disturbing reflections. This is when a man stops to think. And those reflections lead to the conclusion, what's the point? And in verse 11 and 12, he stopped to reflect. Would you look at verse 11? Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold,
all was vanity and vexation of spirit. It was empty and it was purposeless. And there was no profit under the sun. And he's asking himself, what is the point? That's the goad. Verse 12. And I turned myself to behold wisdom. And we'll talk about that in just a minute. But he reflected and he beheld and he looked upon everything that was going on. And young people, if you and I are truly going to become wise, we must take time to reflect. We must take time to think about what we have been doing and what we have been pursuing. What have we been doing with our time? We must think about it. What have we been doing with our money? We must think about it. What have we been trying to accomplish? Well, who are we trying to impress? Are we taking time to think about these things? No man can be wise who does not take much time to think about what is happening. And we are tempted to fill our entire day and night with activities, and even our devotions become just another activity. And our devotions are not, as they should be, times of reflection, times of thought and evaluation. Solomon said in verse 11, then I looked on all the works of my hands. He said, I looked on everything I do, everything I have been trying to accomplish. I looked on it all. And so must we. I like to think of my assignment for the day, of living this life under God's heaven, the same way we would prepare a paper in many ways. Devotions is like writing a paper. You're doing research. You're opening the book and trying to find out what you need to know and what you need to do. And then writing the paper is living the life out the rest of that day. You take all of this research you've gained in the library when you're writing a paper or on the internet, and then you apply that to this document in front of you that you must hand in to the teacher. And our life every day is like that. We get up in the morning and we are to be spending some time in this Word. And we have an assignment today, as we heard sung. We are to glorify Him in all we do, whether we eat or drink or whatsoever we do. Do all to the glory of God. That's the assignment for today. So we go to this book to research and find out, what does that mean? How do I put that together in this situation in my life? And when I'm interacting with my home and my family and with my roommates and with this teacher and with this that goes on in my life and this physical ailment that I have, how does all of that apply? And today I'm writing a paper applying all of that research. And I know none of you have ever done this, and I never did it, of course, and that is just hand in a paper without proofing it. Of course you have. Well, many of you have. I did. And that is a sad thing. And it's obvious to a teacher when students do that, because there are words that ran through the spell checker and they're correctly spelled, but it's the wrong word for that phrase. It's obvious they didn't read it. Well, every day you and I are handing in an assignment to God of how to glorify Him in all we do today. And at the end of the day, we hand in the paper. And folks, we dare not hand in those papers without proofing them. We must throughout the day be examining, what am I doing with this time? How am I using this? What about my words to this person? And what about my ambitions over here? And throughout the day, we ought to be correcting those serious errors and those comma splices and those misspellings and those things all the day long, so that in the evening when we lay our head down and we give this day back to God, we have indeed, with His help, glorified Him in all we did. But that means we've got to take time to think about what we're doing. And if we do not take time to think, it is like handing in papers without proofreading them. They have serious errors in them. And we get a bad grade. Solomon is reviewing what he has been doing.
He's proofing what he has written before he hands it in. And he discovered several serious errors in his paper. Goad number one is that pleasure alone does not satisfy. It's the first conclusion he came to. Pleasure alone does not satisfy. It is vanity, it is emptiness, and vexation of spirit. It's like chasing after wind. It is useless, it is purposeless to pursue pleasure alone. There's some other component that must be a part of any pursuit. And he comes down at the end of verse 12 and he says, there was no profit under the sun. What is the point of all of my pleasure? But then he gives us goad number two. And that is that even wisdom alone does not satisfy. Even wisdom alone does not satisfy. Would you look with me at verses, we'll read 12 to 23. And I turned myself to behold wisdom. Now, what is he doing when he says, I turned myself to behold wisdom? I'm thinking about my pursuit of even wisdom. When he says, I turned and looked on it, he's evaluating it. He's thinking. He's reflecting. Verse 12, and I turned myself to behold wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do that cometh after the king? He said, after I've done everything that I've done, who else can do any more than I've done? Even that which hath been already done. Then I saw. Now he's going to draw a little conclusion. I saw that wisdom excelleth folly as far as light excelleth darkness. The first thing right on the surface is obviously a person who lives a wise life is going to be a whole lot better off than a fool, than a person who does not give any consideration to wisdom. As far, he said, it's so much better. Wisdom is so much better than folly as light is from darkness. Verse 14. An extension of that. The wise man's eyes are in his head. He sees what's going on. But the fool walketh in darkness. And then he says, and I myself perceived also that one event happened to them all. Now he's going to come along and he's going to say, but in the end, the fool dies like the wise man. What's the point? Unless there's something else involved here. Verse 15, then said I in my heart, as it happened to the fool, so it happened even to me. He's talking about death. And why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart, that also is vanity. This is an empty thought. This is an empty thing. For there is no remembrance of the wise more than of the fool forever. Seeing that which now is in the days to come shall all be forgotten. And how dieth the wise man? As the fool. We both end up in the same place in the same way. Therefore, verse 17, these are goads. Therefore, I hated life. Because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me, for all is vanity and vexation of spirit. So what? If I become wise and I understand how to solve problems and all of these kinds of things, I'm going to die just like the fool does who doesn't have this kind of wisdom. And then what's the point of all of this? And again, there is no point in being wise over being a fool if there's not something that transcends all the pointlessness. Verse 18, yea, I hated all my labor which I had taken under the sun, because I should leave it unto the man that shall be after me. And who knoweth whether he shall be a wise man or a fool? Yet shall he have rule over all my labor wherein I have labored and wherein I have showed myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. And he says, furthermore, in all of my wisdom, I create this great empire and I have all of this treasure. And then I gather all of this together and I leave it to somebody who might be a fool and is going to waste it. What's the point of all my labor? And the point is, again, there is no point unless there's something that transcends all this pointlessness. Verse 19, and who knoweth whether he shall be a wise man or a fool? Oh, I just read that. Well, let's read it to go into verse 20. Yet shall he have rule over all my labor wherein I have labored and wherein I have showed myself wise under the sun. This is also vanity. Therefore, I went about to cause my heart to despair of all the labor which I took under the sun. The more I thought about all of this, the more I despaired and I thought, what is the point? Do you ever ask yourselves questions like that? What is the point of this? Anytime you and I are prompted by our reflections to ask, what is the point? We're being goaded by God that we are living life and looking at life without God in that picture.
Now it can happen on a humorous level. I mean, I remember several years ago, I played racquetball for years. And I was thinking one day, what is the profit of all this racquetball? I love playing racquetball. But what is the profit of all of this? Probably what it means is I'm going to live about 6 more months. But those 6 months will probably be in a nursing home. What's the point? You know, I'd probably rather just die 6 months early. So anytime you reflect, without God in the picture, you're going to come up with, what's the point? I plowed my life into this person and discipling this person and working with this, and he walks away and he does this or that. What's the point? Well, there is no point unless you've been living for someone who transcends all of that. I go to college, I get this degree, and I end up with this big debt, you know, and what's the point of that? Or I come here and I have these regulations, and what is the point of this, and what is the point of that? Well, there is no point. If we're just reflecting on the things in front of us, there probably is no point in that we can see. But we must live life with God in this picture, and it takes away the pointlessness of all of it. You put Paul in prison and beat his back bloody. He doesn't say, what's the point? I mean, I serve God and here's what I get. What's the point? Well, there is no point in all of it if that's the end of it, unless there's something that transcends all of that. So anytime you are asking yourself, what is the use of this and what is the point of that? You have just been goaded by God, reminding you that you're living life without Him in this picture. Because you're looking at what He has given you as pointless. But there's a nail here, and it's the conclusion of this sermon, this first discourse. Let's finish up 21 to 23 here before we get to the nail. For there is a man whose labor is in wisdom, and he's talking about himself, and in knowledge and in equity, yet to a man that hath not labored therein shall he leave it for his portion. This also is vanity and a great evil. And he's just repeating that theme. For what hath man of all his labor and of the vexation of his heart, wherein he hath labored under the sun? For all his days are sorrows and his travail grief. Yea, his heart taketh not rest in the night. This is also vanity. Here's a man who's reflecting. And by the way, this is exactly the reason why people who are more contemplative and more thoughtful are often more discouraged and often somewhat depressed. Because they're thinking about life as it really is. They're not just giving themselves these temporary uppers through experiences or whatever. They're actually thinking about life. And when they think about life with all of the components in their life, it is the pits. And they're being goaded to be reminded there is more to life than that. I often run into this when I'm a resident counselor and I are working with a young lady, let's say, who's been sexually abused in her home. And when she just thinks about the way life has been, it doesn't taste very good. And she would say, What is the point? I'm ruined, I'm no good, and all of this kind of thing. And there's a heaviness about it. And I often tell them, you know, you have come to the reality that life on a fallen planet is very, very grievous. And you've come to that reality quicker than some other people have who haven't had your background. They will hit that reality when some things go wrong in their lives and their marriage goes sour, their kids go south, or some other thing comes along. They'll begin to realize the same thing that you're realizing right now. You're getting the lesson really early. And I asked them, have you ever baked bread from scratch? And most haven't. And I grew up on a farm and I would spend some weekends with my uncle. Every once in a while, my aunt baked bread. And when I was a little kid, I helped her bake bread. I don't bake bread today. I wouldn't know where to start in it. But I remember she would take this in this bowl, in this mixing bowl, she would put all kinds of ingredients. And let's say that all she puts in the bowl is the oil,
and this, she would take this little packet of yeast and put it in a quarter cup of warm water and let it sit there for a little while, and then put that in the bowl, and then some salt and some baking soda. Okay, now let's say that's all in your bowl. That's all that's in your bowl, and you stir it up. How's that going to taste? Hey, you want some bread? This doesn't taste good at all. Just like this young lady's life does not taste good at all, because all the ingredients aren't there yet. For her, all of the reality is this monstrous home that she grew up in, and it is a horrible thing, and it does not taste good. But folks, there's a whole lot more to reality than just what has gone there. There is that Lord we sang about this morning. The one who in His love and in His pity did redeem us. And the one who did go up Calvary's mountain and died for us. And has redeemed us from the curse of the law and forgiven our sins. Who is preparing a home in heaven for us, and one day will come and take us to be with Him. This is reality, folks. And if you want that existence to taste good, you're going to have to stir in the rest of the ingredients. The sugar or honey that you're going to sweeten that with, and the bulk of the flour, and all of those other ingredients you're going to put in there. When you put all of that in it, when you put all of those ingredients into the bowl and mix it up, and you let it rise, and then you knead it down, and you let it rise, and you knead it, and then you put it in the oven, and you bake it. When it comes out, it really tastes good. Why? Because it no longer has salt, and no longer has yeast in it, and no longer has these other things. No, all of those things are there. But what makes it taste good is the rest of the ingredients you've stirred into the mix. The knowledge of God and what He's like and who He is and what He's done and what you and I really are and what He's done for us. And you can look at those Hebrews 11 believers, second half of the chapter, of people whose lives weren't going real well. They were sawn asunder. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, of whom the world was not worthy. But as Moses, they endured as seeing Him who is invisible. A lot more stuff in their bowl. And life didn't taste bad. And folks, if your life tastes bad today, and you may have had many bad things happen to you in your life, but if it tastes bad, what you need to do is fold in the rest of the ingredients. And this is what Solomon is saying. What these goads are about is that this is in my life and this is in my life. What is the point of even living? There isn't any point unless there's something that transcends all of this. And that is the knowledge of the God of heaven. Well, we get to that nail. In Ecclesiastes 2, verses 24 to 26, where he says, there is nothing better for a man, and really it would give us better understanding if we would translate it, there is nothing inherent in man that he should by himself eat and drink and make his soul enjoy good in his labor. There is nothing inherent in you and me that makes life turn out good. He said, this also I saw, that it was from this joy, the goodness of life, is from the hand of God. For who can eat, or who else can? And it says, hasten here unto more than I. Better meaning here, for who can eat, or who else, who can enjoy life without Him? Verse 26, for God giveth to a man that is good in His sight, wisdom and knowledge and what? Joy. Did you realize that you and I can only get wisdom from God? Proverbs 2, he says that He gives wisdom to the upright. He gives it. It is something you get from God. Did you know that the knowledge of God and His ways is something that you can only get from Him in this book? And if you don't spend any time in this book, you can't get the knowledge of how all this life is supposed to work. Did you also know that you can't get joy, lasting joy, real contentment, without God? He giveth wisdom and knowledge and joy. Would you turn over to chapter 5? This is the conclusion of the second discourse. But it says the same thing. Verse 18. Behold, that which I have seen, it is good, or it is morally right and comely or beautiful for one to eat and to drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor. God has given us many things in this creation to enjoy. The good of all his labor that he taketh under the sun all the days of his life, which God giveth him, for it is his portion. God has given us things to be doing on this earth and to enjoy on this earth, and he certainly wants to enjoy it. After you get through all of these things, you would expect Solomon to come along and say, all right, y'all, knock it off. Can't have any fun. God doesn't say that. He says, I have given you many, many things to enjoy. But look at verse 19. Every man also to whom God hath given riches and wealth and hath given him the power to eat thereof. God gives the power to eat thereof and to take his portion and to rejoice in his labor. This is a gift of God. Did you know that God can give you the gift of riches? But if he doesn't give you the gift of rejoicing, you can't enjoy your riches. The joy and the rejoicing is a gift, just like the riches is a gift. And you and I know people who have much money, but they have no joy. And the other people have nothing and they have great joy. God hasn't given them the gift of riches, but he's given them the gift of enjoyment, the gift of rejoicing. Anything multiplied by zero is zero. We learned that in elementary school. And if you have this multiplicand over here of, let's say, 6, and you have a multiplier here, 6 times 0, you're going to come out with 0 every time. And you can put all you want on this multiplicand side. You can have 3,080, but you multiply it by 0 and you still get 0. Well, the multiplicand side is what you and I try to do to get things together. All of our pleasures, all of our experiences, all of the relationships we can have that we want in our lives. We try to get all of those stockpiled. But what we fail to realize in the lesson of Ecclesiastes is God provides the multiplier. And you can accumulate all you want on your side, but if God multiplies it by 0, you still get 0 enjoyment. But you can do all you can, and maybe your health isn't good, and your finances, you don't have any finances, and you don't have any friends, and all this kind of thing. And maybe on a good day, on a scale of 0 to 10, all you can get on your side is 2. But if God takes that 2 and multiplies it by 200, you have an enjoyment index of 400. And the point of all of that is that we're spending our time working on the wrong side of the equation, when what we ought to be working on is a relationship with God, who is the multiplier of whatever we have. He's the one who provides the joy in this. I want us to look over in chapter 12 for just a moment at the conclusion of the whole book. This is the conclusion of the whole book and the conclusion of the fourth discourse. Verse 13. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is a whole duty of man. This applies to everyone. This is the core of what it means to be a man. Now, remember, he's writing this to a Gentile audience. They don't know about Jehovah. They don't know about the Exodus. And he says, of the making of these many books, there is no end. But it boils down to this, folks, and this is what I want you to understand and what I've been goading you about through this whole book, he says to his philosopher king friends. You've got to get God in this picture. You've got to know what he says, and you've got to live by what he says. Fear God and keep his commandments. Bow before him and listen to everything he says and do it. This is the whole duty of man. This is what it means to be a man. This is the completeness of man is what this means. For God shall bring every, verse 14, for God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. Fear God, put him in his rightful place. Bring God into the center of this picture. Something that helps me with this a great deal. When I get up in the morning, the first thing I do is sit on the edge of the bed, or if I wake up a little bit before the alarm and I'm still laying in bed, I pray this: Father, because of what he has done for me at the cross, and what He has said to me in His Word, and because of what He will require me at the judgment, with Your help, I want to live all of life today under the Lordship of Jesus Christ. That's my assignment for the day. I do make serious errors. I have corrections that have to be made, comma splices, split infinitives, all kinds of things throughout the day. But the goal is throughout that day to fear God and keep His commandments, live under His Lordship with everything that He has said. And you know what the result of that is for the believer? Great joy. It's a gift. The joy is a gift. You don't get the joy by accumulating. This is the whole secret of pleasure. You don't get the joy by trying to accumulate everything you possibly can on the multiplicand side. The pleasure and the joy comes from doing everything you can to live all of your life under the Lordship of Jesus Christ today, knowing His words and obeying His words and fellowshipping with Him about what He has said and thanking Him for what He has done. And He says, to that man, I give joy. That's the secret of pleasure. So my question to you this morning is, where are you seeking your pleasure? Is it in the multiplicand side of things, all of the experiences and the relationships and all? Are you trying to multiply all of those things and add many things there? Or are you working on this relationship with God in His Word, and you must spend much time in His Word? That is the secret of pleasure.
You've been listening to the Chapel Hour, coming to you from the campus of Bob Jones University. Our speaker was Dr. Jim Berg, Dean of Students at BJU. For a cassette or compact disc copy of today's message, send a check for $6 to Campus Store, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, 29614. Be sure to mention the name of the speaker and today's date. The Chapel Hour has been sponsored by Bob Jones University.